Hello and welcome to Book 3 of Sand Security 660. My name is Steve Sims and I'll be taking over from Jim for the remainder of the course. So in this book, we're going to be focusing on a few different things. We're going to start off with a module on product security testing, and I'll explain all about that and why you should care. Then we've got a module on Python 3, and we just recently updated it to Python 3 from Python 2 because Python 2 is, of course, end of life. Real soon here, if not already passed. And the reason we left Python 2 in for so long is because it's still heavily utilized. There's a lot of scripts and applications written in Python 2. Some examples, like just recently, IDA moved to 7.4 and supports Python 3. But all the way up until October 2019, they only supported 2.7. Immunity Debugger has dependencies on Python 2, and a lot of these tools that we've used have those dependencies. So we'll probably still see a mix of using both versions going forward. But if you're going to start a new project, you should absolutely start with Python 3. And we'll look at some cool things there. We've got a neat lab for you to go in and edit DLL characteristics to turn on and off exploit mitigations. I'll also mention IDA Python and show you a little bit of that and how it works and some cool things you can do. Then we've got a module on Scapy. And the Scapy module is going to take you through some packet crafting. We're not going to spend a ton of time there, but the rest of the day is spent on fuzzing. So Scapy can be used as a packet fuzzer, and there's a lot of power there. It lets you pretty much craft any type of packet you want, and it's written in Python, of course, and depending on the operating system you're on or what you've downloaded and which version of Scapy, it might have dependencies on different versions of Python and such. So either way, we've got some neat exercises for you to do there as well. And then the remainder of the section, the book, the day, whatever you want to call it, is spent on fuzzing. And we'll begin looking at what is fuzzing and define it and some things that you need in order to be able to do it well. And then we'll talk about different fuzzing techniques. I'll do a demonstration of a fuzzer that was written, but it's pretty limited. It's a mutation fuzzer, but it's neat to see a fuzzer that someone else wrote and what some of the limitations are. And that's kind of the difficulty with using fuzzers written by other people is that it may work, but it may have been written for a very specific purpose. And if it's not open source, or if you don't know how to script a program, you might not be able to extend that. So we'll look at that real quickly, but we want to spend more of our time on a fuzzing framework. So a framework that allows us to write our own custom fuzzers without having to worry about a lot of the things that we shouldn't worry about, which is already a part of the framework. And we'll get back to that later on. And then we're going to focus a bit on code coverage, both code coverage from the perspective of if you don't have source code and you're just doing basically closed source or black box fuzzing, you're going to have to do measurement based on the blocks of code you hit at the assembly level. And if you do have the source code, then we can do source code assisted fuzzing. And we'll talk about that with the American Fuzzy Lop, the AFL fuzzer. And that's pretty much the focus of this book. There's quite a few exercises, and in the extended hours or boot camp, there's a bunch of additional things that you can work on as well. Okay, so we're going to begin with that module on product security testing. The objective here is to understand what is it, we want to define it, how do we prioritize, what does our testing environment and tools, what should they look like, bug discovery and disclosure, what to do when you do find a bug, and then documentation and reporting. So I'll tell you up front, this is a bit of a soft module to start off the day, but I feel it's really important because I've worked at a couple different organizations where one of my roles was to do product security testing. When you think of network pen testing or wireless pen testing or web app pen testing, we all know what those are, but what's product security and product pen testing? If let's say you work at a bank and your bank has 100,000 employees and they want to buy voice over IP phones for every single employee. They might buy Avaya, they might buy Cisco. Either way, that's a lot of devices that you are putting on the network. Now, you certainly wouldn't want this expensive device that you're buying in large quantities to be vulnerable, and maybe that's the reason if there was a breach in your environment, it's because of that phone or that other product that you purchased. you shouldn't assume that the vendor who makes the product you're buying has gone through and done rigorous security testing. I mean, I should change the wording there. You should be able to assume that, but you shouldn't assume that. And if you follow people like Tavis Ormandy and Project Zero on Twitter, you've seen that for a while there, he was taking on password management tools and antivirus products. And he was finding hit after hit after hit against these products that are supposed to be protecting us. And they're products that are running as root or system. And if there's a vulnerability there, then that's obviously a big issue. One example, there was this guy, I won't name his name, but a few years ago, he found a few significant bugs in FireEye products. And he, supposedly the story goes, he went to them and they kind of ignored his request for a response saying he found some vulnerabilities. And so he got frustrated, understandably so, and released one of them publicly on Twitter. I do remember that part, and said, here's a 0-day affecting FireEye, and I've got 3 more if anyone wants to buy them. Well, that, of course, suddenly gets the attention of the company, and then they, I believe, came after him a bit with some legal action. The story continues. I believe Google Project Zero started to do some research on the products as well, and it turned into this whole thing. And the point I'm making there is not to pick on any one vendor, because every vendor has these types of problems. It's that if you're a company or you're responsible for products being purchased for your environment, you certainly want to make sure that the security testing's been done to avoid any potential vulnerabilities being introduced into the environment. Now, that being said, it's time consuming. It's not for everyone. Not every company will be able to put or allocate those resources to do so, or they may not have the expertise to do so. But when you get into a larger organization, medium to large to giant, and you've got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of nodes, and you're considering buying products like the ones you see listed on this slide, antivirus and smartphones and intrusion prevention on the network and NAC, these are devices or software that are sitting in line at critical areas of the network and aggregate areas, or they're on systems that if there were a vulnerability in one of these products and someone were able to exploit them, they can get access to that system, and that's their foothold into your environment. So there's a lot of considerations there. So that's why I feel so strongly about product security testing. Again, going back to the fact that you should not assume that the company from which you are buying products has done rigorous security testing. So some initial questions, and a lot of this is going to be pretty obvious. You're like, well, yeah, of course I need to know the type of product and the size of the deployment. But it's here to be thorough, right? We want to make sure that we've got everything that we'll possibly need on the slide. So yes, some of this is absolutely intuitive. So we need to know the type of product. How big is the deployment? Because that's going to kind of maybe change the way that we prioritize and do our testing. If it's only 10 of these products that are being bought and they're being put onto in places in the network, maybe that we're not as concerned about, or systems we're not as concerned about, then maybe we can change the way we approach it or change the way we test. If it's something large, a larger deployment that's going all over the place, that's truly going to affect how we approach this thing. The location, again, is it inside a protected enclave? Is it at home users? Is it on some sales environment? Where is it? What type of data elements are stored on this device or passing through this device? So is it PII data and such? User access level. So is this a lockdown device where it's just an interface that you are presented with and you can't get access to the underlying kernel? Think like an iOS device with Apple. Or is it something where you actually can get and debug it and get down into command prompt and everything else? That's going to change the way you approach it. And then business drivers. Business drivers gets into things like justification. Like, why are we doing this? Why are we implementing this technology? Is it the right thing to do? This is why we need risk assessment teams and governance and tracking of this, because let's say if you're at a large company, your large company might have 50 lines of business. And if one line of business decides to go forward with the project and that what they're doing could impact the rest of the company if there was a compromise, that one line of business certainly shouldn't be able to take on that risk on behalf of the whole company. That needs to work its way up to, you know, your chief InfoSec officer and other folks who are responsible for that. So it's okay to ask the questions. I've seen it before where like the sales team or the marketing team wants to use some cool new tool that does help them with their job, but maybe they're not thinking about it from a security perspective, which is why you want to have that enterprise risk process. So ask for justification. Why are we doing it? How is it helping the organization? A lot of time it's funding that drives prioritization. You know, who's getting the money to do what? Is it something that's a cost center, or is it something that's going to generate revenue or other? So prioritization, and this is coming from my personal experience when I put this slide together, like what are the main areas of prioritization? And one I've commonly come across is, what is the company most worried about? Is it regulatory compliance that's driving this project or solution that's being purchased or looked into? Is it that we're worried about intellectual property exposure, where that could destroy our company if someone did data exfiltration of our critical assets? Is it access to sensitive records like credit card data? Like what is it that we are concerned about? And that's going to drive prioritization. A lot of companies never would have spent any money at all on security had it not been for regulations. Also, how much time do we have? If you have a small security team and your security staff are responsible and wearing many hats, they may not have that much time to dedicate to something like product security testing. So how much time we have is going to determine how many resources we can spend on this. And it's going to limit our ability to test for certain things. And imagine if someone said to you, hey, you've got the next month to evaluate this ATM machine that we're considering using for our bank, or this new MRI machine for a hospital or whatever. You have a month to do it full time. I mean, that'd be amazing. Unfortunately, that's not usually the way it works. In some cases it does, some cases it doesn't. You do have some companies that focus on things like medical device security, like insulin pumps and such, or you might have companies that focus on car hacking, and these individuals may have a lot of time to focus on that. Sometimes it's based on grants and other factors, but realistically, for most of us, we don't have the ability to spend full time on something. So we need to relay those limitations to the requesters. If someone's coming and saying they want to consider deploying a new product in the environment, and in order for you to do a thorough evaluation, it would take you 2 months, but you've only got 1 week that you can spend on it. And oftentimes that 1 week is due to the fact that the requesters wait till the last minute before they want to go live into production with something, before they engage you. So that's something you have to track as well. But you want to be honest and relay to the requester, I only have time to test these components. I do not have time to test the other components, and get that in writing that they understand it. Because what you don't want to happen is, if that product or software is involved in a compromise or breach, then to be able to say, well, didn't so-and-so test this, and now you're telling us it was the reason our company was compromised? I'd want to be able to point to a document that says I wasn't able to test those things and you signed off on that due to time constraints. Executive projects, these can be seen as things that are likely to happen whether you like it or not, or have already happened and you're kind of retroactively going to assess it. It could be tablets or smartphones, it could be wireless devices, just new toys. Maybe an executive's friend started up a company and they're, hey, try our new product out, and they just stick it on the network without asking. I'm not saying all executives would do this. I'm just saying that it happens. Take another example of a hospital. I remember working on a pen test or an assessment at this one particular medical group, and they said they don't have wireless, but all the doctors were walking around with wireless tablets and they had access points set up. And, you know, from their perspective, nobody could read their handwriting, and taking notes takes longer than typing things in or whatever, or doing it digital on a tablet, and that way it's recorded electronically. So they were just using it without asking permission. Well, there was no project to go in and secure that and implement it securely. So those kind of things are what I'm talking about here. You often have minimal time for assessment, or again, it might have already happened. A good side of this is that oftentimes it's limited deployment. So it's something that's smaller scale, because it's just a group of leadership team who are utilizing it. And this could also apply to marketing, where they didn't ask to use something, or sales, or whoever else. So ready to test, once you've prioritized and you've gotten sign off on it, and they may not like it, they may say, no, we don't want you to just test those things. We want you to test all the things. Well, then you have to say, I need more time then. Either way, you've got prioritization established. The scope of the testing is defined. You are focusing on the biggest areas of concern, coupled up with that time constraints and such. You begin your work now. So one thing we want to do, and this is post rules of engagement, scoping, all that stuff. Now the work begins, the fun part, right? So maybe you want to go look for any external research. So Google and find out if anybody else has looked into this product that you're looking into. I always go back to one example that comes into my mind. When Vista came out a long time ago, I was asked by the company I was working at to evaluate the operating system to determine if from a security perspective, it's such a great increase that it makes sense to pay the money to move on to Vista. And I remember Googling, and someone named Ali Whitehouse, who worked at Symantec, I believe at the time, had done a lot of the research that I was being asked to do. So all I had to do then is take that research and go and validate it, because you always want to validate other people's findings because you're putting your name on this as well. And then, you know, continue onward with the other things you have to do. So that can help you cut some corners, save time. So your testing environment, test or treat each product that you're evaluating as if it's unique, and it should be unique. There might be some similarities between different products. Like I did assess Avaya and Cisco side by side, and there were similarities, but obviously there were differences. So treat each one of those using, like, you know, you can call it the scientific method, as unique. Some basic items needed. If virtualization is possible, you want to do virtualization of the company OS builds or anything you can virtualize. Hardware, you need, of course, laptops and switches and cables, depending on what you're doing. Disassemblers and debuggers, you may not always have time to disassemble things or debug things, but it's a good skill to have. And in my experience, people who say they never have time to do it, oftentimes it's because they don't know how to do it, or at least do it quickly. If you're an expert at disassembly and debugging, then you'll find yourself just naturally going that path anyway. And if you script a lot of things up, and if you're quick, you can achieve a lot more, and those opportunities will unfold. Fuzzing tools. So if it's something that requires fuzzing, you want to have a fuzzing framework. You want to know some scripting language. We talked about that already. Sniffers to be able to examine network traffic and such. So these are just some basic things you can probably expect to need. The operating system version of embedded devices and widgets. I mean, this is a big one with the world of IoT. The Internet of Things, Linux kernel 2.4 and 2.6 are quite old, but you still see them all the time on different types of IoT devices. If you go and look at the firmware and you start examining it and you unpack it or whatever, you use something like Binwalk and you start looking at the file system again and navigating, you often will find very outdated things. And so there's also a lot of old systems still running in production doing specific things. So you will come across them, and I'll just create a fake story here and say, imagine if you were going to UC Stanford in California in the Bay Area, and you're working on your PhD, and you work with your advisor, and your advisor says, hey, the research that you're doing is really interesting, and I've got some VC, some venture capitalists, who I think would be interested in your idea. And do you want me to set up a meeting? Absolutely. Of course you'd want that. So you set up the meeting, and the VCs who just throw money around say, we'll give you $10 million to do this, to start this project. And we want it to go to production in 1 year. So let's say you're creating some network security device, and you start doing your development. And when you do your development, you're going to be doing it on a specific platform, right? You're going to choose some Linux variant and whatever kernel versions out at that time. You're going to be working on your dev. As time goes on and you get closer to that release date, a commitment, stress goes up and security becomes an afterthought, and you need to get that thing released. So do you think the day before release, you're going to say, oh, wait, we need to upgrade the kernel to the latest version real quick? No way, because that's going to break things. We've all seen things like Kali Linux. When it comes out with the next version, a bunch of tools that you may have used on a prior version breaks because things change and you've got to go and fix that stuff. So you wouldn't do that, right? You wouldn't probably go to production and say, well, we're going to upgrade the kernel real fast. So that's why a lot of times these products get stuck on these old Linux versions. We've all been on an airplane before where they reboot the entertainment system and you see Red Hat version old and Linux kernel 2.6. So that's, it's a good idea to keep a spreadsheet of all the different kernel versions out there and the inherent vulnerabilities associated with them. One example would be VM splice. The VM splice vulnerability that came out against Linux kernel years ago affects very specific versions, but there really was no way to upgrade it or to patch it. I mean, you had to upgrade the kernel to patch it. And so if you find those old versions, you know they're vulnerable. I intentionally, I probably shouldn't say this now, but on the capture the flag, leave a couple kernel versions old. And because there's an intended path for you to exploit it, but then there's also, you could do the other way where you find some old kernel exploit and get it working that way. So reverse engineering and debugging, this is something that you don't just start out knowing. You know, you think about, we all have friends and even ourselves who say, I want to learn French. I want to learn German or Japanese. If you only know a single language, and that sounds like a great idea, but as an adult, it's hard. If you're a child and you learn it, you're immersed in it, it's easy. If you're an adult and you decide that you want to go learn a second or third language, that's very difficult. So it's time consuming and requires a lot of patience. Same thing with the programming language. If you want to learn C++, it's going to take work. If you want to learn reverse engineering and disassembly and debugging, it's going to take that same kind of work. So it is time consuming. What most people do is it's a hobby first. They do it after hours. They do it when they have spare time, and then they get better at it. And as they get better at it, they're able to start using it in their day-to-day job. So you've got a bit of that learning curve, I guess we could say, that you need to take to keep in mind. When I was learning how to do exploitation, I remember I would just read and work on reverse engineering because I had a half hour to sit on the subway. And any chance I would get, I would give up sleep. And it was a hobby of mine. I gave up video games to focus on that. And to me, that became my video game. And it became really rewarding and constant learning curves. But once you get better, then you can start using it. So a lot of people say, how do I get that job doing exploit dev if I don't already have the skills? Well, it sounds to me like you're expecting the job to pay you to get those skills. And that's, unfortunately, a lot of us don't have that type of job unless you work for like certain branches of the government and such. So it's got to be kind of a balanced approach. You've got to put in some of the work yourself, and then your employer hopefully sees that and wants to invest in your education and helps you along the way. A lot of us, though, it's a hobby. And we get good enough at it to where we can then try and get a job doing it. We go and do talks, you do research papers, you write exploits, try to get some CVEs, those types of things. So I'm just giving you some kind of general info there. But it is time consuming. Even if you're good at it, it's time consuming. And it can help you, though, with fuzzing and bug finding bugs and weaponizing bugs and all kinds of neat stuff. So, of course, it's restricted by the level of access you have to something. There may be obfuscation tricks. You may be locked out of something. There may be terms of use that you're violating. So factor all that in. IDA is a great tool for reverse engineering. Now, there are many alternatives. Ghidra came out at RSA conference last year from the NSA, and that's a fantastic tool. There's a Radar2. There's Binary Ninja. There's Hopper. There's a bunch of disassemblers out there. I personally stick with IDA Pro still. It's like the gold standard, I guess you could say. It supports debugging and it supports all kinds of really useful things that we like. One thing it doesn't support, at least not at this point, that Ghidra supports is collaboration. But, you know, it's a balance. One tool is not going to have everything. And so what I really like to use is the IDA Python support and my familiarity with the APIs, the debugging, as I mentioned before, and the visual, the actual interface itself, the UX and all, it's very attractive compared to many of the alternatives. So it's a disassembler that can disassemble machine code back into its mnemonic representation. So it takes a 90 in x86 and it disassembles it into a NOOP. So it does that. It also identifies blocks of code within a function, and they're called dynamic edges, and it identifies those edges and lets you know from what's called a recursive descent manner how you can go in one direction or another based on maybe a string comparison or some Boolean operations, and we'll see examples of this. Now, with reverse engineering in general, we're going to get much more into that in book 4 in the first module and onward. You will see disassembly in this module, in this book, but we're not going to focus too much on specifics. So it also provides many graphical and structural views, reads symbol libraries. Let me show you a quick example. This is IDA right here inside a Windows 7 system. And what you see in the main window in the center, that's one single function. And we can kind of drag it around. Over on the left, these are all the functions within this particular binary. And this is Sophos Antivirus Main Engine. It's one of the Sophos versions. And so if we double click on another one, it takes us to a different function. And we can zoom out and we can zoom in accordingly. It's a really ugly function. Doesn't even look like a function. Anyway, let's go over here. We can click up on the image map up there and we can zoom out. You can see kind of the overall way this function looks. Now, if we zoom in at the very top of the function, that's going to be up here, your function's entry point. So you've got a function entry point up here, and that's where when you call this function, you would begin. And then if we go down, you can see there's this instruction that says jump not zero, jump if not zero. Well, how is it going to determine whether or not it takes that jump? Look above that instruction. It says test byte pointer and some memory address to one. So it's going to go and check to see if what's stored at this memory address is equal to one. And if it's not equal to zero, you're going to take the jump. And if it is equal to zero, you're going to go down linearly to the next instruction here. Otherwise, you would go down here to this one. So pretty neat how you can just read through that. And there's a lot of comparisons happening. And I mentioned before the idea of edges. So this is one block. These are all blocks of assembly that have been identified. And most of them end with something like a call or a jump. Like here you can see jump on zero, a mandatory jump. So there's usually something that's happening, like a comparison. And whether or not you take one path or the other is going to be dependent upon the result of that comparison. So that's kind of just reading through some disassembly. And like I said, we'll be doing a lot more of this as we go forward. There's also things like the imports table. So we had talked about that previously, I believe, the import address table. We can see the different modules that are this application has a dependency on. And we can see within those modules which functions we need to import and link them. So it's dynamically linked. And if this were a DLL, it would have a heavily populated exports, but it's not a DLL. This is an executable. There's many other things to look at in here. One cool thing that at the bottom is a Python command bar. You can type in Python commands and interact with the underlying API and automate a lot of really cool stuff. So when we get to the Python section, I'll come back and I'll show you an example of an IDA Python script. But it's also got debugger support. Supports many different architectures, so a very useful tool, but a learning curve. So a question you might have to ask is it a denial of service only, or is it an opportunity for code execution? So denial of service, most bugs or vulnerabilities start out that way. You're fuzzing or you do something and the process crashes. And if you do it again, it crashes. You don't just get automatic code execution. You need to go and, of course, weaponize it and determine if it's even exploitable. So that takes work as well. It's easy to find bugs and cause things to crash. It's harder to determine if it's exploitable and getting a working exploit and getting into the context. Like, okay, I'm causing a crash to occur, but how do I reach that line of code in a debugger? And then I've got to look at the environment and determine whether or not it seems exploitable. So that's something we want to be careful with. Some vulnerabilities stay a denial of service, or not vulnerability, but some bugs stay a denial of service. Other ones could potentially be weaponized. What you don't want to do is say, I discovered a vulnerability, but it's just a denial of service and it can't be weaponized, but then find out later that you're wrong and someone else weaponizes it. So I usually like to say, you know, given the time I had to spend on this particular bug, I wasn't able to gain code execution. Nothing easy stuck out. Doesn't mean it's not possible, but given the time constraints, again, what you don't want to happen is someone to come back and say, oh yeah, I've weaponized it. I remember a long time ago, this site called Millworm, which is what eventually became ExploitDB, but Millworm was like, I don't know, back when things were really cool, and everybody posted their exploit code there, and you can go and find kind of like how you can do today. It was a little different back then. And I remember this one person posts up, hey, there's this denial of service vulnerability I found. And the wording he or she used said it was, I found a vulnerability. Don't bother trying to weaponize it because I couldn't do it. In other words, I'm so good that if I couldn't weaponize this vulnerability and it's just a denial of service, that you couldn't possibly do it. So that's the way it came across, which is pretty, you know, narcissistic. And so this person, Phantasmagoria, came along and weaponized it and came back and said, posted it and said, yeah, you're an idiot. Probably wouldn't have done that had this individual not been so cocky about it, right? So just a funny story to point out. So testing proprietary applications. This is a good and a bad thing. It's a good thing because if you're asked to test a proprietary application, chances are it has not been publicly made available. It's internal only. And that means there's probably lots of vulnerabilities to go and find in there. Every time I've been involved in a pen test of an internal application, it's always riddled with bugs or vulnerabilities. Now, the downside of that is oftentimes there's no documentation. It's not following any public standard or RFC, and that makes a lot more overhead or work for you investigating it. But you can do things like try to find documentation, start writing your own documentation, use sniffers, write your own packet or protocol parsers, but again, time consuming. So let's say you discover a vulnerability. Now what? You got to factor in these items on the slide. Corporate disclosure policy, what does your company allow you to do? Most of the companies I worked for in the past did not want to have any attribution to finding vulnerabilities. So, for example, if you work at a company and they want you to do product security testing, but if you find a vulnerability, they want you to just work with the vendor and disclose it privately and to not get credit for it, well, then that's what happens. You don't get to have credit for it. And most of the places I've worked, that was how it works. Other companies who maybe that actually looks good for them, like Project Zero, for example, they like having the names on there, Palo Alto Networks, or if you're at FireEye and you find a vulnerability, that makes your company look good, right? So that attribution is a positive thing. But let's say I work at Bank X and I find a vulnerability and I post it up on ExploitDB and somebody says, why is Steve Sims from Bank X releasing 0 days or posting exploits that would affect my company potentially? That's not good attribution. So that's up to you and your company, and you got to sort that out, of course, and follow those guidelines. The vulnerabilities that I've released publicly, because most of the ones I've found that are anything good, I've sold them. And when you sell a vulnerability or an exploit, you don't get to take credit for it typically, unless it's some kind of bug bounty program. It depends. But if you're selling a vulnerability, an exploit to a third party or a buyer, they own that and you don't get to own it anymore and you're not allowed to talk about it and you're not going to get credit for it typically. But ones that I have personally disclosed publicly, just little ones, I've used a couple different handles. So I've got like two handles that I've used over the years just because I don't want the baggage that comes along with it sometimes. I've been burned before where I've gone to a company and did a private disclosure out of the goodness of my heart. I was on an airplane, found a bug in a product, go get off the plane, send it to them, and then a lawyer comes after you on behalf of that company. And you're like, no, I'm not going to tell anybody about this. I just want you to fix it. I randomly chose your product and was letting you know. And the lawyer's like, well, look at it from our perspective. This random supposed benevolent person comes along and says, hey, guess what? I found a vulnerability. Here's an exploit that can exploit it. And I remember talking to this one company and they said, we're a startup. We're on like round 5 of funding, which is not a good place to be. They're like, we're just now getting some customers like Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin, and you send us an email. We don't know who you are, and it's an exploit against our product. That doesn't make us real happy. And can you understand that? And like, yeah, okay. When you spell it out like that, it makes sense. I just personally don't want to deal with the baggage that comes along with that. But you know, there's a lot of good programs out there and proxies out there that can help you with disclosure. So let's go through this. I already talked about your disclosure policy. Just make sure that you are not violating that. Some companies say stuff like any code you write while employed, whether or not you're on the clock, still is their code. And that's them trying to protect their intellectual property. But you want to know if you're in violation so you don't do that. They should all be handled responsibly, of course. Types of disclosure. There's full, limited, and responsible, I guess from a high level. Full disclosure is no vendor coordination. You just go public with it and you don't give the vendor a chance to fix it first. Responsible disclosure is the opposite, where you go to the vendor and you responsibly disclose it to them and you say, I'm not going to tell anybody, but you need to patch it. And then they release a patch in their next cycle. Limited disclosure splits the difference and says, well, you know what? Some vendors, if you responsibly disclose it to them, they take their good old time to patch it. And 6 months goes by and they're still like, nah, no, we're not going to patch it yet. We're still working on it. That's not cool, because chances are someone else will find that same bug at some point. So by doing limited disclosure, you tell the public about the existence of a problem, but you don't give out the technical details, and you give the technical details to the vendor only. And that way it sets a little fire underneath the vendor, because the public knows about it and they're expecting a patch quickly, but there's no technical details released. But you want to be careful as to how much information you give out publicly with limited disclosure, because someone could, if you give enough information, try and start hunting for that bug. Full disclosure, why somebody might go that path is because some vendors will go after you with a lawsuit and they'll make your life difficult, and you may want the problem to be fixed quickly, but you don't want to deal with the drama. I certainly don't advocate full disclosure, but I understand why some people have done it. Appropriate contacts. So you want to make sure that when you're doing a product security assessment, that you've got direct contacts to technical support, to engineers, to developers, whoever you need to reach that's not going to waste your time. Because if you only have a week to do an assessment and you have to wait 2 days to get a response from the company developers, that's not going to work. So you want to make sure in advance, who are my contacts in case I have any questions? And it will save you a ton of time. Remediation efforts. So patching may take months. Different disclosure guidelines out there from like Project Zero and others, they may say 60 days or 90 days. And if you don't patch it within that time period, then we are going to release it publicly. And that does happen. If you're interested in getting credited and your company allows it, let the vendor know. And that way you get tied to the CVE or whatever it is. Make sure you resist the urge to discuss the vulnerability with others. Remember, back, at least if you're like me, when 2003 came out, I downloaded Metasploit, and it was MS-03026, which is DCOM, MSRPC DCOM bug, and I typed in the target and payload and hit exploit, and bam, a shell's on my screen. I was like, wait, is that really the shell of the remote system that easily? I just type exploit and it magically appears. It was my first experience with a framework. And it was super cool, and you're like, you get a natural high from it. You're like, what? It's a crazy, you get goosebumps. And then you do it a few more times, and that natural high starts to wear off a little bit, you know, because you pop shells all the time. So, you know, finding a zero day is a way to get that back again. Like not like a SQL injection bug. Those are a dime a dozen, but like a binary vulnerability against a browser or something. That's like exciting. And when you do that, it's a feat. It's an accomplishment, and you should be proud of yourself, and it's exciting, and you want to tell other people. But think about what could happen. If you tell others, oftentimes that information gets leaked out, and the finger's going to come pointing back to you because you are the initial one who disclosed it. So be careful there. Severity and an impact. So you're typically, when you're doing a product security assessment, you're doing a risk assessment, right? And you want to take into consideration things like what policies are being broken or violated, and are there any mitigations that we can put in to solve some of the findings temporarily, or does it require a code fix? What are any residual or long-term mitigations that can be put into the code to fix the problem? Can you make any other recommendations? Like, those types of things are going to be what people are expecting from your report. And a final document, of course, the typical things, your high-level executive summary, which anyone who reads that should get value from it. Even a technical layman should be able to read the executive summary and get value. It shouldn't be super technical. And then your detailed summary, you get more technical. Your testing performed in the environment to help justify why you're spending thousands of dollars on IDA. You know, that's a good spot to put that. Who was involved? Any findings, any security policies that were violated, and factor in those formulas like qualitative and quantitative risks, any mitigations that can be applied, recommendations, and then appendix for more verbose information. Those types of things are very useful. So that brings us to the end of the product pen testing or security module. Hopefully you found that useful. It is a really fun thing to go and do assessments on products. So if you have time to do it on the side, it's a good approach to take to get some experience there, demonstrate the value of that to your organization. Well, we've all heard pen testers talking about how they've broken through a printer or through an IoT device, a wireless router, or so on and so forth, any vector, any gateway into the organization. Especially back to my point, if you're rolling this product out to critical network locations or systems or tens of thousands of instances, it absolutely is worth the time if you know how to do it to do a product security assessment. Let's now move on to our module on Python for non-Python coders. So as I said in the beginning of this particular book, when looking at Python, well, first off, we had to choose a language. And why not Ruby? Why not Lua? Why not Go or Rust? Because Python's a very user-friendly language. It's quite mature. A lot of the security tools that we've been using for years and continue to use are written in Python or have Python support. Many of the tools and frameworks we look at in this course are in fact written in Python or have Python support. And I had mentioned Immunity Debugger and IDA and many others, Scapy that we'll look at, the Sully fuzzing framework and BooFuzz. So all these are written in Python or support Python, and that's just what we chose to go with. But there's nothing wrong with any of the other languages out there, of course. So that's one thing I wanted to say first. Also, this isn't a replacement for going and learning how to write code in Python. We can't teach you Python in a half hour, 45 minutes. So we do have a lab at the end of this exercise that will give you some good hands-on experience, but you're going to definitely have to go back if you don't already know the language and practice. It's a module where if you already know Python, that's great. It'll be a bit of a refresher. We're going to focus on Python 3, and we'll have a nice lab for you to do at the end. Hopefully, you'll pick up a couple of new things. If you know another language, but you don't know Python, hopefully it excites you in wanting to go and work with Python. And if you're not familiar with programming or scripting at all, then hopefully this is a nice friendly way to kind of entice you to want to learn more about the language. So objectives, again, teach current coders to adapt skills to Python if you don't already have that experience. We want to do an overview of the Python syntax. So we will talk about some basic items that we should ramp up on or refresh on, like variables and data types and control statements, but specific to Python 3. We want to look at using Python modules, some useful snippets, and especially we'll talk about C types and PE file module as well that we'll be using in an exercise. So first off, executing Python programs. First thing you should notice up there, we're saying Python 3, and we've got your Windows system set up accordingly so that you've got both Python 2 and Python 3 installed. And that's because we have a lot of exercises that depend on Python 2.7, I believe it is. So we also have Python 3. And either if you're on Kali or if you're on Windows, you're going to type Python 3 regardless. So at the top there, we're saying Python 3 minus C, print A times 10,000. And if you're used to Python 2 and you haven't played much with 3, notice that we put the parentheses around the print statement as the way it should have been all along. But it's a bad habit, and I have it myself, where I'm just so used to typing things the older way that I forget sometimes to do it the right way or the Python 3 way. So that would just print A's onto the screen. And we can execute programs or commands directly from a command prompt by using the minus C argument. And then we can run scripts, of course, or programs by, in the second example, we're catting out helloworld.py. Of course, a very simple example of print and then hello world. But then we do dot slash and we execute that to the interpreter. It runs it as is and we get the desired result. So that's running it more as a script. And then at the bottom there, we can just type in Python 3 and it puts us into the interactive interpreter or terminal. And we can execute commands or programs directly there from that environment. So moving on to Python numeric types, we've got integers and we've got floats. Now, integers in Python 3, they're not size constrained to the CPU size as they were back in Python 2. So if you remember, if you looked, in Python 2, there was an integer type called long, and that was there to handle integers that are larger than 32 bits or 64 bits, respectively, associated with the processor size. So that's not the case with Python 3. You can go beyond that natively, which is nice. Also, the floats, so a float point, you think of something like the pi on the example there, 3.1415. The decimal point is the floating point, and we can have some number of values after that. We can't go beyond 16, though. We've got to round up, and there's a link in the book in the notes that shows you kind of why that is the case, why you can't go beyond 16. But for our purposes, I can't imagine a case where we need to go beyond that anyway. So string types, if you're familiar with a simple string, it's just a sequence of single characters, ASCII-readable characters typically. So we've got the UTF-8, which is a multi-byte Unicode character set. Now, we're most familiar with one-byte characters, which are things like hexadecimal 41, which is a capital A. But as they extended that to support other things like special characters with, let's say, a Latin or a Greek alphabet, that's going to require 2 bytes to represent that single character. And then we can go beyond that and look at things like Chinese characters and Korean and Japanese, and even beyond that to things like mathematical symbols and other special symbols that may require 3 or 4 bytes to represent a single character. So the example we see over on the right there, we're just simply saying hostname equals sec660.sans.org as a string. And then we're saying injection equals quote, quote, quote. So why the quote, quote, quote? Because in this example, we want quotes to exist inside the string. It's kind of like we're escaping them in a way. And we want to be able to do that by wrapping it with triple quotes or triple apostrophes. And then we've got a path. You can see we're escaping the quotes. We're escaping the backslashes there so that they get printed out accordingly and recorded in the string. And then we're saying print path, and it prints out the way we expect it. So that's just an example of basic strings. Now, bytes are a bit different. These are non-UTF-8, and they can be between 0 and 255. You'd want to think of as bytes as a sequence of bytes, in other words. So it's a sequence of bytes, and strings are that sequence of characters. So characters, like ASCII characters or Unicode characters, versus bytes, which may be like base 16 values that aren't an actual ASCII character or similar. So just there's a difference there. Think of like binary strings and such. So one thing about bytes is that you can't change part of it, a value, when you create it. You can't go in and say, I'd like to change offset 1 starting from 0. And you can see that in the middle image to the right. It says B index offset 1 equals hex 89. You can't do that. It says it's immutable. You're not allowed to. So if you want to be able to make changes and a little more flexibility, we can utilize a byte array. And for this example, I'll just go and type something out here on the screen. So I'll type Python 3 to get into the prompt. If you don't type Python 3, it's going to default to Python 2. So we'll say BA, just a variable name for byte array. It's arbitrary. And we'll say byte array, tab completed there, just to show you that you can. And then we put inside square brackets within the parentheses some hex values. I'll use 0xFF, 0xDD, 0xAA, and 0x33. And then we'll close that out. So it took that in. And then we'll say print BA, and it prints it out. Now notice that it automatically converts anything that's an ASCII character, like 33, over to its ASCII value. It does that by default, which is fine. Just pointing out that it does it. Now we can also go in and say, well, let's change offset 1, so the DD, to something else. And to do that, we say BA, and then the position offset from 0, which is going to be 1 in this case, and I'll say equals 0x11. And now if we print it out, you can see we changed DD to 11. So we've got that capability there. So let's continue on here. Let's try something like for I in BA. So a little for loop, which we'll talk about for loops more in a moment. What did I do here? I didn't put a space. So for I in BA, print hex I. and then just close that out. So what that did was just iterated through the byte array, printing out each value one at a time. Now, a funny thing is, back if this was Python 2 and we did this, we could just put a little comma at the end and hit enter, and it would print it all on the same line. But that doesn't work in Python 3. As you can see, it didn't like that. So what we can do is, there's a couple different ways we can compensate. The way that I'll do it is just put a comma after the hex I and put end equals and then quotes with a space around it. And then that prints it all on the same line for us. There are other ways you can do it, but that's just one example in case you cared. So that should explain the difference between string, bytes, and byte array. So next up, string, bytes, and UTF-8. A little bit more detail here. Strings are converted to bytes with that encode method, like it says there at the top. And that can be used, like it says, convert strings to bytes. And then the decode method allows us to decode bytes to UTF-8 strings. Now, it doesn't always work that easily, but that's the idea behind it. One thing to point out, the most significant bytes in the UTF-8 string, that's going to determine and specify or dictate whether or not it's a 1, 2, 3, or 4 byte character. So that's the most significant bits that determine that. And if you mess that up, you'll see some error messages printed out to you. So on the top there, you can see sec660.sans.org.encode, and it prints it out as we'd expect it, because those are all ASCII readable 1 byte characters. Then below that, we say we've got this snake symbol and then /x41.encode. And it displays it as bytes and shows us the A on the end because that's ASCII readable. But then it's a 4-byte value to represent that little snake. So that's interesting. And if you try that on Kali, it probably won't work because I don't think the language pack for that particular symbol is available. But other Linux variants, it should work no problem. And over on the right, you see /x A9, which is the copyright symbol, and then we encode it, and you can see that that's a 2-byte character. So just interesting to see that, trying to understand a bit more about UTF-8. And then again, bytes are converted to strings with the decode method. Not all of them can be converted to UTF-8 characters, though. You can, if you try and decode bytes that has no UTF-8 character associated with it, it's probably going to throw some issues. So you can see in the example on the bottom left, we've got a byte string, and we've got F0, 9F, so on and so forth, dot decode, and it shows us that snake, and that snake value matches up above in the example. So that's all fine. And then we've got another one with some other symbols showing up, and it's all good. But then look on the bottom right, we do a byte string, a single byte of hex 80 decode, and it comes back and says, Coda can't decode byte 80 in position 0, invalid start byte. So for whatever reason, it's not thrilled with that particular value. There's no UTF-8 character associated with it, so it doesn't like it. So it's better to leave that as bytes. If you want it to display anyway, you can use that interesting Latin 1 character set to get around it, because it only has 255 characters, I believe, supported. So just some weird, interesting notes on UTF-8 strings and encoding and decoding.